Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Nayman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who discusses how Republicans in the House blocked a vote on a resolution to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. Mark Jacobson, director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, who describes his vision for how the U.S. and the world can achieve conversion from fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. And Jeremy Ornstein, an activist with the Sunrise Movement, who talks about his group's recent sit-in at House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding the incoming Democratic House majority take action on climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Facing a growing outcry, Bangladesh canceled the repatriation of more than 2,000 Rohingya Muslims back to Myanmar, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fled after Burmese soldiers burned down their villages. Although the governments of Bangladesh and Myanmar had negotiated a repatriation agreement, no Rohingya volunteered to return, fearful of rape, murder, and arson. The plan was widely condemned by the United Nations, Asian leaders, and human rights groups. Some 2,260 Rohingya refugees were put on a list for return to Myanmar without their consent. Families whose names turned up on the list fled refugee camps, and several refugees attempted suicide. Over 700,000 Rohingya fled last summer after their villages were attacked and burned to the ground by soldiers and Buddhist mobs. According to a recent United Nations report, thousands of Rohingya who remained in Myanmar were subjected to horrific conditions in detention camps surrounded by barbed wire. Al Jazeera reports that the Rohingya, who had their citizenship rights stripped in the early 1980s, are calling for international protection guarantees before any refugees return to Myanmar. The Southeast Asian nation has denied any responsibility for abuses against the mostly Muslim Rohingya minority. A group of Rohingya refugees has called on Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, for compensation and reparations. Suu Kyi has come under intense international criticism from human rights groups, Asian leaders, and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. Online retail giant Amazon won $5.5 billion in tax breaks and incentives at the end of its year-long search for new headquarters. In the end, Amazon decided to co-locate its new headquarters and 50,000 high-paying jobs in both Long Island City in Queens, New York, and Arlington, Virginia. The backroom deal offering large tax subsidies has led to an angry response among some political and community leaders in Long Island City, a rapidly gentrifying area across the East River from Lower Manhattan's skyscrapers. Queens political and community leaders were excluded from the negotiations led by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Amazon's proposed new campus along the East River would kill a plan to build 1,500 units of affordable housing on the site. In Seattle, Amazon's presence in the city has been blamed for a 40% increase in rents over the past 5 years and a steep rise in homelessness. Queens State Senator Mike Gianaris complained, "This is no way to allocate this vast amount of public dollars without local oversight or input from the community." The Queens Anti-Gentrification Project insisted Amazon's new headquarters would make rents and daily life unaffordable for most Queens residents. Louisiana farmers produce 13 million tons of sugarcane each year, generating $3 billion. It's a lucrative crop thanks to regulated production limits and tariff rate quotas that protect U.S. growers from foreign competition. As the American Sugarcane League proudly notes, sugar has arguably been the most successful crop in Louisiana history. For years, black sugarcane farmer June Provost has complained of harassment and discriminatory lending practices that have forced many of Louisiana's black farmers into bankruptcy. in Louisiana's Iberia Parish, where Provost farmed, the number of black farmers fell by 45% between 2007 and 2012, while the number of white farmers declined by only 12%. In the early 1980s, 60 black farmers worked the land in the parish. Now, according to the Guardian newspaper, only 4 remain. In September, with the aid of noted civil rights attorney Hank Sanders, the Provost family filed a lawsuit against First Guaranty Bank for discriminatory lending practices, violating the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Housing Act, and various state regulations. The lawsuit claims the bank required excessive collateral for loans, forcing Provost to reduce his sugarcane acreage against the advice of Louisiana State University agronomists. On September 26th, the Provosts lost their home and surrounding acreage to foreclosure. The property went to First Guaranty Bank, the sole bidder. June Provost and his wife Angie say that they'll continue to fight to prove that the sale of their home was an illegal foreclosure based on years of discriminatory lending and fraud, and that they will work to launch a class action suit on behalf of other black sugarcane farmers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
As the death toll in the Saudi-led war in Yemen rises ever higher, famine has taken hold, threatening the lives of some 14 million people. Although the Yemen war has received little attention in U.S. corporate media, Washington has been actively involved in the 3-year-long conflict, supplying the Saudis and United Arab Emirates with weapons, logistical and intelligence support, and until recently, provided mid-air refueling for Saudi warplanes, which have frequently targeted civilians. UN-sponsored talks to broker a ceasefire that would allow desperately needed emergency aid into the country are scheduled to take place in Stockholm in the coming weeks. With world attention now focused on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have recently pledged $500 million in food aid to assist millions of Yemenis on the brink of starvation. After the Saudi murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul, there's been growing pressure to end the U.S. role in the Saudi-led military campaign. But when House Democrats attempted to open debate on a war powers resolution to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war, House Republicans used a rare parliamentary maneuver to block debate. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about the Republican tactic to shut down debate and a vote on U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today.
So there's a key provision of the War Powers Resolution, which, remember, the purpose was to try and Congress trying to give itself tools to reassert its Article I powers under the Constitution. One of the tools that they put in was to say, if the president starts a war without congressional authorization, in violation of the Constitution, then a single member of Congress can call the question by introducing a privileged resolution and force a debate and vote on the House floor. But the fine print is that unless that House shall so determine by the yeas and the nays. The trick that Paul Ryan used was the House has a powerful rules committee. In general, every bill that goes to the floor is preceded by a rule approved by the Rules Committee that governs how that bill should be considered. The trick that Paul Ryan used was to use the rule on a completely different bill, the Manage Our Wolves Act, which is about delisting gray wolves. In that rule, they inserted language saying HCON Res 138, CONA's Yemen War Powers Resolution, CONA Massey Bipartisan Bill, is deprivileged. It is deprived of its guaranteed vote. That was the trick that they used. And generally, it's very hard to defeat the majority on the rule because it tends to be a party line vote. Nonetheless, we tried. And actually, we were only shy by 7 votes. 6 Democrats voted against us. 15 Democrats voted on our side. So it was actually closer than a vote on the rule would ordinarily be. But that's how Paul Ryan got around the vote, by that parliamentary trick. That's terrible and it's frustrating. But here's the silver lining. First of all, it shows that Paul Ryan was yellow to meet us in a fair fight. And that indicates that he was afraid that in a clean vote, too many Republicans would defect and vote to end the unconstitutional war. The second silver lining is that there's a companion resolution in the Senate, which is the same resolution that Bernie Sanders, Mike Lee, and Chris Murphy brought forward in March, Senate Joint Resolution 54. That was tabled in March in a vote of 55 to 44, but it was not killed. It was only tabled. And the Senate parliamentarian has ruled that Bernie can bring that back anytime he wants, and he has pledged to do so after Thanksgiving, as early as the Tuesday, November 27th, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. We could get a vote in the Senate. You know, we don't know what's going to happen, but it seems quite plausible that we could win that vote in the Senate. That would be world historical. Nobody has ever won a vote like that in either house before, certainly not in the Senate. Murphy, Senator Murphy, told Defense News some weeks ago that Sanders, Lee, and Murphy would have won the vote in March if there hadn't been a sneaky deal to replace that bill with a fake certification by Pompeo instead. Secretary Pompeo was certified. Saudis are trying to reduce civilian casualties. Everybody knows that's a lie, but Pompeo certified it anyway. So that's the second silver lining. We have a vote coming up in the Senate. The procedures in the Senate are different than the House. There's no way that McConnell can block Bernie from going to the floor. The third silver lining is that Representative Khanna can reintroduce his bill anytime he wants with a new bill number, same text, same content, new bill number. And then it was once again privileged, once again guaranteed to go to floor. Of course, Paul Ryan could do dirty tricks again. But if he tries that in the context of Senate passage, it's a very different world. Also, the context of the world has changed. There's tremendous pressure on the U.S. government and the Saudi government now, pressure on the United Nations. The British are active. Houthis have announced that they're ready for a ceasefire. Some press reports indicate that the UAE wants to end the war. The Saudi government is isolated diplomatically, particularly after their murder of the Saudi-American journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. So we're in a different moment now. We could end this war within the next 2 weeks. And one thing that's going to be key is what Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse do. They're in Rhode Island. They voted against the Sanders resolution in March. If they switch sides and vote with Sanders and Murphy, your senator in Connecticut, now, that could tip the balance towards Senate passage and ending the war.
That was Robert Naiman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy. Learn more about efforts to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a sobering report issued in October, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's leading climate scientists, issued a dire warning that the nations of the world have only a 10 to 12-year window to take action to limit an increase in global temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade. The report concludes that an increase beyond 1.5 degrees will substantially increase the likelihood of disastrous drought, wildfires, crop failures, flooding, extreme weather events, and coral reef destruction. At an early November event sponsored by the Connecticut-based group People's Action for Clean Energy, Mark Jacobson, director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, addressed the challenge of climate change, outlining the ways in which the U.S. and the world can achieve conversion from fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. Jacobson, a specialist in climate modeling and co-founder of the Solutions Project, thinks that the U.S. is now equipped with the necessary technology and economic means to stop burning fossil fuels. The only thing that's missing, he says, is the political will. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended Jacobson's November 8th talk in Hartford, Connecticut, and brings us these excerpts.
So what I want to talk about today is all these renewable energy plans that we've been developing over the last decade. Our first plan came out in 2009 in Scientific American on how to power the whole world with clean renewable energy, or to really see is it possible, even though we can't actually implement a global scale plan on its own because there's nobody who just controls the whole world. Since then, we've been developing individual state plans, country plans, and now city and town plans. But I just want to point out this one paper that we did in 2014, which was had a lot of co-authors, including some from back east here and a lot of students. This is a plan to repower California for all purposes with just wind and water and solar. I'm happy to say that this was actually implemented into law a couple months ago with SB 100 in the electric power sector by not only the state Senate, the state assembly, and the governor signed it finally, but the governor also issued an executive order that is not binding on the next governor, it's just been elected, but really indicates what his intent is, which was to repower California for all purposes with clean renewable energy. And it effectively goes to 100% renewables by 2045 with 60% by 2030. More recently, we've noticed just in this last election, there were three new governors who all have the platform of 100% renewable energy, including in Illinois, Michigan, and Colorado. And Nevada passed at least the first step of a 50% renewable portfolio standard by 2030. So there is some progress. Hawaii has a 100% clean renewable energy standard. So there have been a couple of public opinion surveys. One was last November. It was 13 countries, 26,000 people took part in the survey, including in the US and Canada. But it's interesting, 82% of the people surveyed said they wanted a world with 100% renewable energy. That's not more renewable energy, that's 100%. That's 8 out of 10 people in the world, if this is statistically accurate, want 100% renewable energy, which is amazing. But what's kind of scary is only 66% of the same people believe climate change is a significant problem. The only good news about that is that you don't have to believe in climate change to believe in clean and renewable energy, which is fine. If you don't have to believe in the problem, as long as you want to solve it, that's fine. What is the reason for that? Well, 69% of the people said renewables make countries more energy independent. 73% say renewables will boost economic growth and jobs as well. So there are a variety of reasons people like renewable energy that they don't necessarily believe in that climate change is a significant problem. In the US, there are several resolutions pending in the House and also in the Senate, maybe the House ones could actually be voted on now, to go to 100% renewable energy. There's a House Resolution 540 that has 60 co-sponsors that calls for the United States to support a transition to 100% clean renewable energy. There's a Senate resolution for a similar thing. There's Senate Bill 987 to transition from fossil fuels to 100% clean and renewable energy by 2050. And there are actually two House bills that are pending, H.R. 3314 and 3671, that one calls for 100% by 2050 and the other is 100% by 2035. So these are literally sitting in Congress waiting to be voted on. But actual laws that have been passed include Hawaii, 100% renewable electricity law by 2045, California, a similar one by 2045 with 60% by 2030. Vermont, actually more aggressive, 75% renewable electricity by 2032. This is on the books. New York has a 50% renewable electricity law by 2030. And well, so if I want to summarize, I didn't talk about jobs, but we did and analyze the job creation in all 139 countries and all 50 states. And we find that worldwide, we can create 24 million more long-term full-time jobs than lost. In the US, it's about 2 million more. We would require only a fifth of a percent of land for footprint for solar PV and CSP with these world energy plans and 0.9% for spacing between wind turbines. We'd avoid 4 to 7 million air pollution deaths per year. We could slow, then eventually reverse global warming. We think we can keep the grid stable throughout the world with 100% renewables. The cost per kilowatt hour is slightly less than that of fossil fuels, but health plus energy plus climate costs are per kilowatt hour 1/4 that of fossils, and the absolute energy plus climate costs are 1/8 because we're using 50% less energy with the wind, water, solar system. Finally, transitioning to 100% in all energy sectors We think it's technically and economically possible. The main barriers are social and political. The solution does require collective willpower of everybody. And we can't just do it in isolation with a few examples. We have to, everybody has to help, or at least want to help.
That was Mark Jacobson, Director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University. Learn more about Jacobson's vision for moving the nation and the world to 100% renewable energy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Less than a week after Democrats won back control of the House of Representatives in the November 6 midterm election, some 200 climate activists conducted a sit-in at Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi's office on Capitol Hill. The young activists from the Sunrise Movement and Justice Democrats were joined by newly elected Progressive Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and demanded that the Democrats make climate change a top priority when their party takes control of the House in January. U.S. Capitol Police arrested 51 protesters during the action. The urgency of addressing climate change comes as the last 4 years have broken all records for the highest global temperatures since climate data was first recorded in 1880. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report that warns that the world has only a 10 to 12-year window to take action on climate change. And President Trump's executive order, signed last year, that will dismantle the Obama administration's most far-reaching climate change regulation, the Clean Power Plan. Your reporter spoke with Jeremy Ornstein, an 18-year-old activist with the Sunrise Movement, who talks about his group's sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's congressional office and the demand to develop a comprehensive plan to address climate change, known as the Green New Deal, a progressive vision for environmental sustainability and economic stability.
Speaker Pelosi, or seemed to be Speaker Pelosi, proposed after the Democrats flipped the House, proposed the idea for a climate committee that would be bringing back a committee from the mid-2000s. The goal of the committee would be to gather evidence around the climate crisis, and that was all she said. And after working so hard for 6 months trying to elect really largely Democrats to our government, our movement, and frankly our generation, a lot of people my age who had voted for the first time were really frustrated because I was a big high school Democrat in my high school years, Scott, and I know that I poured a lot of time and energy into, like, not just electing Democrats but also organizing people my age to support Democrats, and I have a lot of hope that the Democratic Party will be the vehicle of actually building the political will to stop climate change. But our leadership failed us so vividly when soon-to-be Speaker Pelosi talked about this committee to educate, because we know we've been getting evidence for the past decades. We need action now, and that's what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this big group of the world's top climate scientists, says. They said we have 12 years to radically transform our economy and society. So part of the goal of the action was just to expose the gap between what we know we need, between what we fought for over these past 6 months, and what Democratic leadership, what their plan is. In exposing that, to both put pressure on the House leadership, to put pressure on regular members of Congress to get behind a real plan, and to expose this gap between what we want of them and what they're really doing to try and get people to act.
Jeremy, I did want to ask you about one important goal that the group that sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office had, and that was to push the idea of something known as the Green New Deal. Can you explain what the Green New Deal is regarding the environment, climate change, as well as jobs, creating jobs?
Yeah. The Green New Deal is a plan to decarbonize our economy in the next 10 years while creating jobs for anyone who needs one and centering the needs of the communities most impacted by the climate crisis. And so we're envisioning this to be what will really be a sort of very complicated package of legislation. And when we call it the Green New Deal, hearkening back to the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, from the 1930s. And so one element of it will be finding some ways to go shift to 100% renewable in all sectors of our economy, really in the next decade, because that's what this report from the world's top scientists says that this country has to do to like make sure that our world doesn't go past the reversible amounts of global warming, reversible amounts of carbon in the atmosphere. We've got to transition to 100% renewable by 2030. So that's one really important part of the Green New Deal, is that it would make sure the government finds ways to support 100% renewable transition. And a second really crucial part of the Green New Deal is that in coming together to stop this climate crisis, we also want to make sure that this transition is just, and that people who will be losing their jobs, who will be affected by these changes, can also be supported. And that's why part of the Green New Deal is the idea of a job guarantee that, especially in this day and age in this country, and especially when we're fighting something so large as the climate crisis, we're going to need all hands on deck. And that means if one of the proposals in this policy package is if someone needs a job, that they should be able to get a job, a federally funded job to do something to fight the climate crisis. And part of what's interesting about this is there are so many shovel ready jobs that got to be filled, updating infrastructure, building walls to protect from rising sea level. These are things that we can give people shovels and help them get to work. And the notion is also that these jobs should have high minimum wage and should have real benefits, so that workers can live on them. Over the coming months, we'll be promoting the Green New Deal as a plan to make sure that regular people have a voice and have a part in making it a reality.
That was Jeremy Ornstein, an 18-year-old activist with the Sunrise Movement. Learn more about the Sunrise Movement's campaign to make climate change an urgent priority across America by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.